Bienvenidos a Crónicas de la Raza. Welcome to La Raza Chronicles. We want to begin today's program by honoring the life of Pablo Milanés, a Cuban musician whose trova, singer-songwriter music with guitar and voice changed the world. His songs that became incredibly popular became the songs of social movements around the world. He infused traditional Cuban arrangements with political themes and was one of the founders of the Nueva Trova movement.
He died last week
at 79. Pablo Milanés, presente. On today's program, we focus on music and how it can heal and transform us. We bring you an interview with Bay Area legend, percussionist John Santos, around his upcoming EP release, as well as his show this Friday at the Freight and Salvage. We also bring you an interview with Puerto Rican singer Ile, and we bring you an interview by our own Nina Serrano with Bob Baldock. Bob Baldock died October 22nd of this year, but was a very important figure in the Bay Area and in the world. He was one of the few U.S. citizens who participated in the Cuban Revolution and actually fought in the Sierra Maestra in 1958. He also worked to support independent publishing and independent radio for most of his life. He organized public events for KPFA, and he will be sorely missed. This interview that you're about to hear was conducted by Nina Serrano in 2016 and speaks to some of his experiences in Cuba. Bob Baldock, presente. We'll begin with that interview. All this and more, stay tuned.
This is Nina Serrano for La Raza Chronicles. My guest today is Bob Baldock. For the last 30 years, he has been producing events for KPFA, live events, and in the process has created over 400 posters of those events, making for an enormous social history of our wonderful station. Welcome, bienvenido, Bob, to La Raza Chronicles.
Muchas gracias, Nina. So wonderful to be here with you.
You recently, at La Peña, at a celebration for the life of Fidel Castro, made a presentation about your own experience with the Prime Minister. Could you share that with us, please?
I'd be glad to. I'll just set in reading it straight from the copy that exists. My commentary is dedicated to Kathleen Weaver, poet, author, translator, the wings of my heart. From early March into August of 1958, I was a member of Fidel Castro's 26th of July movement. I was a combatant. I want to say something about Fidel that I believe is not much known at all. We all know about Guantanamo Bay Naval Base, the U.S. military compound, prison, and torture facility located on the southernmost shore of Cuba, where the Sierra Maestra meets the sea. Rising high over that shore is Cuba's tallest mountain, Pico Torquino. High on Pico Torquino, near La Plata, some 60 years ago, there was a hut, a bohío, where something really remarkable occurred. That hut had wooden plank walls, thin ones, and a thickly thatched roof. For at least one of the months I was on Pico Torquino, this hut served as hospital and jail together. Our wounded or sick fighters were taken there to be cared for. The critically injured, those needing surgery, were kept separately. Wounded rebels, along with captured Batista soldiers, wounded or not, were kept together in this hut. Life there reflected some of the extraordinary thinking of Fidel. Our own wounded or very sick fighters were bedded side by side with enemy soldiers who'd in fact been sent in patrols up the mountain to kill us. As far as I know, this was unique even for a civil war in that it revealed both Fidel's strategy and his humanitarian heart. It also must have reflected the long year he himself had spent in prison, following a 15-year sentence suspended after that 1 year. I'm certain Fidel's compassion toward enemy prisoners was also bolstered by some of his long conversations with Celia Sanchez, his primary personal confidant in the mountains, and with Haiti Santa Maria, whose thinking always showed her compassionate nature. Both women were essential to Fidel during all the months I was with him. Almost everything was discussed with them. He listened avidly. Equally essential was Fidel's very close friend and personal physician, Dr. Rene Vallejo, an older guerrilla who in fact had served in the U.S. Army, and fortunately for me, spoke excellent English. He invariably took evening meals with us and kept a protective eye on Fidel. In those 5 months in their company, I never once saw a single instance of Fidel acting out the impetuous caudillo, the solitary big man. He was incontestably our leader, unquestionably the most valued individual there. When food, for example, was in short supply, the women always made certain Fidel got at least an egg or two to accompany the omnipresent malanga and rice. While he was frequently in touch with Che and Raul in another front altogether, many hours away in the Sierra Cristal, Fidel's own inner circle, present on Pico Turquino, supported Fidel's expectations of us when we were in that rustic shanty that was hospital and jail. Any of us who spent time there were fully expected to simply comply with Fidel's wishes. We always did. Dr. Vallejo told me that most of our guys understood the strategy of deferring to soldiers, of showing them neither contempt nor hostility, but respect and kindness. After all, they were also Cubans. They were all young, those I saw in the long week and a half I had in that hut, late teenagers or in their 20s or very early 30s, a few of them, often illiterate, sugarfield campesinos or workers from small tobacco farms who had enlisted in Batista's army simply to earn a puny salary for their families. These foot soldiers were never the career military officers perpetrating psychotic crimes against Cuban students, workers, and other citizens. These young inductees had been told that the rebels in the mountains were vicious, criminals, torturers, eaters of human babies. Some of the soldiers we captured believed this, or appeared to. We were expected to help correct the propaganda they'd absorbed. We were expected to help them comprehend that we not only cared about them, but that we wanted their lives and their families' lives to become much better. We tried to assure them that was indeed our reason for being there. They'd been sent out from their forts and garrisons in small expeditionary groups to climb high into the mountains and confront civilians, guajiros making skimpy livings on very small, scattered farms, just to get information about us. They'd been ordered to kill any of us they encountered, and of course they expected the same of us. Once captured, they were usually exhausted, held at gunpoint, trying to restore their breathing and their composure. Most were openly terrified. Some started weeping. Their weapons and backpacks were confiscated immediately. As soon as they were brought into the hut, their boots were taken away. There were no beds. There were a few cots. There were at least 8 hammocks, hoisting one above crawling insects, except for the large tarantulas that nested in the roof thatching. These were to be killed on sight. A tarantula had earlier bitten Fidel, although not in that hut, swelling his left forearm massively, rendering it limp for many days. The captives were always given the available cots or hammocks. Our own wounded slept on bedrolls or mildewed blankets on the floor. Food was scarce. When there were only a few eggs or a wood-grilled portion of mule or burro that had fallen or been shot, it was offered first to captives. We also gave them cigarettes. We reduced their terror. We sat beside them. We put our arms around them. We gave them abrazos. After all, we felt for their plight. We were capable of tenderness, and we were proud of it. There was a roof holding out rain. The oil lamps worked. In that place, the enemy seemed so amazingly like us. There was a guitar. The same songs were known by most. Increasingly, there was singing, and then laughter. White or black or more often mixed blood, no importa. We were all young, energetic, astonishingly together, high in the mountains. After a few days of their captivity, we released uninjured prisoners. They'd be given their boots, led to a trailhead, given instructions how to return to their units. We kept the weapons, maps, ammunition. Eventually, they found their way back to their garrisons, most of them anyway, where they had stories for their friends. By mid-August, bacillary dysentery had taken away one-third of my body weight and nearly all my energy. I had become useless, if not yet a distinct liability. One morning, following many hours of talking together, Fidel told me he was going to get me to a hospital for treatment, an authentic hospital, one in Miami, Punto. He didn't want me questioned in Havana. Who knew what might happen? I was to leave the next day, escorted by two of the compas. That afternoon, Dr. Vallejo helped me tell Fidel how profoundly I believed in his ideals and how much I loved him. That very fall, mere months later, Fidel brought his outfit together with Raul's and Che's Frente, and they all began moving down the mountains on the 700-mile thrust toward Havana. I heard that they encountered surprisingly little resistance from the garrisons and forts along the way, not even from the Air Force tracking them from above. I heard that the 26th of July ranks swelled considerably with enthusiastic volunteers, many of whom had only recently discarded Army uniforms. Viva Fidel. Siempre. Siempre.
You just heard Bob Baldak of KPFA. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, Nina. I'm so glad to be able to get across what sometimes other people do with enemy soldiers as opposed to what this country's been doing.
Well, it's an amazing, amazing story. How did it happen that you were with Fidel? How did you join up with the 26th of July?
Well, I was working until I got laid off in the recession in a rubber factory in Akron, Ohio, and I went to movies and they had newsreels, and one of these newsreels was about the guys in the mountains in Cuba, and I was fascinated, and I contacted a friend who had grown up in Guatemala and said, you know, what do you think? Should we go there? But before that happened, I went to New York. Basically, I got a job as a copy boy for the New York Herald Tribune. At that point, a very good paper. And I got to use and look at the maps and so on. And we decided to go. We hitchhiked. Once we got to Cuba, we made our way south, somewhat very covertly, in fact, because, well, it was a terrible journey. I mean, Batista had bodies hanging on so many of the utility poles and telephone poles going down the central highway, and they were being eaten by critters and so on. And by the time we got to Bayamo in Oriente, we met up with someone who had some contact, and we said we wanted to go there. And we were carrying press passes, so we were allowed up. And actually, it's sort of startling how easily we were brought into the unit. And my own training in ROTC for a couple of years, the only 2 years of college I've had, stood me in good stead. And when I saw what was going on and really felt it, I wanted to be part of it, just that.
And you were.
Yes, I was.
Well, it seems like you're always carving out a piece of history, both in Cuba and here at KPFA, where you've made 400 posters documenting our social history. You're also a painter, isn't that true?
I paint, yeah. I don't talk very much about it. It's not that. But I've been painting for, I don't know, 50 years, I guess, yes.
Mm-hmm. And did you do any drawing while you were up in the Sierra Maestra?
No, none whatsoever. No. No, I'm sorry, I didn't.
Well, we're very proud that we have a beautiful black and white photograph here in KPFA of you as a handsome young man next to another handsome young man, Fidel Castro.
He is 10 years older than I was, but it was an amazing circumstance that, in fact, you know, my own father was an engineer of many trades and was away much of the time. We rarely had supper together. This occurred to me a few months ago that Fidel was, in fact, not just a mentor, but he was the first male that I regularly had suppers with every night for months. And we were close.
Well, it's been an honor to speak with you. It's been a pleasure. Muchas gracias.
My name is Jesse Morelos, and today we have a very, very special guest, singer, songwriter, activist, Grammy winner, Ile. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm very excited to have the opportunity to interview you today. Congratulations on your latest album release. I know that was released on October 21st, and it's been doing really great.
Thank you.
I've been a fan of your work since I was in college, and I've seen your progression. I've enjoyed listening to all of the sides that make up you. And all I can say is this album is fire. I've been playing the songs nonstop from beginning to end, and I've gone through an emotional roller coaster of feeling happy, sad, empowered, you know, and ready to go fight the fight, you know, and then just mellow. And it's been an amazing journey being able to encounter your music. So it felt very fluid and very strong, and it felt very personal. Can you talk about your thoughts along the creation of this album and also how you chose the thematics and who you chose to collaborate with?
Well, it was a lot to deal with, like not only just, you know, sitting and working on this album. I think it became so much more than that. Because like, I think all the time it comes from, you know, something that maybe affects me somehow, but I think like this time it was like a combination of many things at the same time. And it was very overwhelming for me to try to manage so much at the same time, or try to, you know, focus, feeling like very disoriented and very confused and lost, kind of. So I just kept writing, you know, I just remembered that I was just writing and composing without, at the beginning, I wasn't sure if it was going to be for an album. So it started just like from that. But then like when things like became like more serious with the pandemic, and then suddenly it was like, okay, like we don't know when this is going to end. I kept writing, but you know, it was hard for me to work this album the way that I was used to. And I think that was like my biggest lesson, to, you know, to try to deal with a new way of working an album. And it was like mainly because of that, because it was so difficult to you know, to feel organized like I was expecting to, with everything around me feeling so disorganized. So I as well, like I was kind of, you know, absorbing all that energy. So I felt like that. So, you know, writing was like my way of trying to organize and understand my feelings and what I was going through at that time. And I think that translated into many things. It translated for me into the instrumentation, into the sounds, into the play of voices, and also in the collaborations as well. Like for me, it's my first time like exploring with collaborators, you know, more like singers mostly. And it was a very vulnerable moment for me, you know, to share something that I was working on with someone that I know very little or don't know at all. So it was part of that uncomfortableness that I was working on, you know, collaborating. But I've never ever expected that I was going to work with so many. I think it was like it became a lot better than I was expecting, you know. Like maybe, you know, I was worrying too much with everything that was going on, and I didn't have no idea like how it was gonna happen, like all this collaboration thing. And then suddenly like ideas kept coming up and new voices kept coming up, you know. And then suddenly I was like discovering some artists, others that they're always there, and then suddenly it's like, oh yeah, like maybe they do click with this song. And suddenly everything became a lot more fluent, or, you know, like everything flowed better. But it was still like difficult to manage all that at the same time.
Even though it was difficult to manage, your previous albums sort of had a theme or more of like a genre specific. And this one seems like you explored many different sides of you. I don't want to impose my thoughts on you, but would you say that this is more representative of Ile? Because I know musicians are more than just the genre that they typically play. Like they have different influences that make up who they are.
Mm-hmm. Maybe in an unconscious way it is, because I feel that I was not as conscious with this album as I feel that I was with my first two. Like I feel that my first two albums were more like things that I really wanted to play with, like things that I wanted to explore, and I felt that I needed to do like somehow, and it's like an important part of who I am. But I guess that it's because like I haven't had the chance to, you know, to play with like deeper sides of myself maybe. And I think that this album has more of that, because yeah, like it, like I couldn't get away with this time, you know, I just like, it just happened and I just let it happen. From a particular moment, like I felt that I needed to do this as well, but it was uncomfortable for me. So yeah, maybe because of that, it may have like deeper sides of myself.
Y luego una pausa, se oye como un feedback en el micrófono, como si estuviera viento o algo moviéndose.
Ay, puede ser el abanico. Ya lo moví.
Okay, muchas gracias. Okay, continuamos. I really love your voice. I think it's very enchanting. I don't know. Whenever I listen to the variations and how the ranges that you have, it sort of reminds me of what maybe like a mermaid would sound like. This like enchanted tone of voice that draws you to them. I listen to your lyrics, and you are very forward thinking, very progressive, very transparent about your political views as well. Was there a strategic choice for the artist that you chose to collaborate? Like I know Trueno, his lyrics are very political as well. Flor de Toloache, Natalia, Mon Laferte. Did you choose them for that reason, or was it just because of their music?
It was a combination of things. I feel that like, I felt like a connection, you know, with them. It was like a musical connection, but as well, like, you know, something energetic maybe, because like, I think most of them, I haven't met them. Well, no, I mean, Trueno, Evie are the only ones I think that I haven't met personally yet. But I mean, like, I feel that I felt a connection with all of them somehow, like their music spoke to me somehow. And, you know, things like that happen, like are maybe like difficult to describe, because I feel like that is something like more energetic. And, you know, you never know exactly if it really is like that until you write them, you know, and start the conversation. But with all of them, like, it was very surprising for me to have like great conversations with all of them, you know, like even if they were from a distance, like with all of them was very, they were very easy to reach. And, you know, like we understood each other very well. And for me, it made it, you know, a little easier to, for me to, you know, find a vibe, you know, with what I was working on. So yeah, I think all of them have something that I feel that I connect with what they are doing.
Serena, you mentioned Evie Queen. I want to dig deeper into Algo Bonito. The lyrics say, they start off by, se pone pesada mi artillería, a todo el que me ataque lo devoro como leona de cacería. Mm-hmm. I listened to the song and it sort of felt like I was marching on the streets fighting for my rights. And it had that vibe to it, you know, that this is an anthem, you know, that could actually be marching to on the streets and demanding what I deserve. And I listened to that song over and over again, you know, because it's not just like the lyrics, it's the beat. I can actually feel my heartbeat sinking to the beat of the song, you know, which is so incredibly powerful. I heard that you didn't think that this collaboration would actually happen, and it was a suggestion by one of your brothers. How did it come about?
It was like my brother Gabriel told me, like, why don't you do something with Evie? And I said, whoa, like, it would be incredible. Like, but I felt that maybe she wasn't interested, you know. Like, I don't know, like, I felt like I didn't know, like, we are so different. And it was like also hard for me to say, you know, what can we do together that can, you know, can make us click, you know, like harmoniously. And at the same time, like for me, maybe she felt like unreachable somehow, you know, but then I gave it a chance, you know. I started working on the song, and obviously, like, the, you know, the reason when I listened to Evie for the first time, that I was like a girl, maybe preteen or teen, I don't remember. But I do remember, you know, feeling, you know, shaken somehow, because I felt like, whoa, like with the reggaeton that I have been listening to, suddenly, like, this song, I feel that it's what I feel as well, you know, like, it was from a very feminine perspective with a very firm and direct, like, feminine voice. And it was super necessary for me for reggaeton. And at the same time, like, it's when those things happen that you say, whoa, like, this was lacking in this type of song. So she definitely was an inspiration for me from that, you know, as a woman. I feel that we already had, like, that connection. So I said, okay, like, maybe this song has to be, like, very, very, you know, fiery and, you know, very aggressive, but, you know, very direct and very feminine. So I started writing my part, and, you know, I wrote to her, and she was very intrigued. So it was very surprising for me. Like, she was intrigued. I said, okay, like, she's not ignoring me. So it was nice, like, to feel that vibe from her. And then suddenly, like, I sent her the idea, you know, not expecting anything, you know, or maybe, you know, expecting whatever happens. So then suddenly, like, she was very excited about the song, and she liked it a lot. So it was super incredible for me. And then suddenly, you know, when she sent me her part, it was like super amazing. I enjoyed it a lot, and she gave, like, that strength that it needed, and you know, with her presence and her voice, it was like it was even more powerful. So for me, like, I feel super grateful that she's on this album.
Yeah, and the way that she finishes the song, tú a mí me hablas bonito, okay?
Yeah,
I love that.
You know, like, it's como fronteo.
Yeah, me encantó. So what is the tour looking like? I know you're going to be here in San Francisco in March. So we have a few months, you know, until then. But I'm guessing that now that the album is out, there's a few shows.
Yeah, San Francisco is on March 13th in the Great American Music Hall. Mm-hmm. we're planning the tour for next year, but, like, right now I'm having a US tour around March, but hoping to travel to other places as well and present this new album. I'm super excited for that. So, like, we're still organizing and arranging the dates. But super excited. Like I presented recently in Brooklyn in Public Records. It was like a more of a, you know, a release party almost, and it was super nice. But I think like next year we're going on tour.
That sounds amazing. And well, of course, we're going to be promoting the show and we'll be there as well. I honestly cannot choose a favorite song from the album. I know I keep on saying this, but it's definitely my favorite that I've heard in quite a while, like from top to end, from beginning to end.
I'm glad. Thank you.
So I want to change gears a little bit before we wrap it up. I want to talk to you about a subject that is dear to you, Puerto Rico. And again, I know you're very transparent and open about your feelings about what it should look like. I know that there was a few changes that happened over the pandemic. You ousted the governor, and then the same political party got reelected. Has there been any changes? What is the political situation, climate right now in Puerto Rico? And then what does ILE think would be an ideal situation or a path forward?
Well, I mean, right now everything is becoming a lot more chaotic, maybe, because like a lot of investors are coming to the island, you know, to evade taxes, and they are buying a lot of buildings, and a lot of displacement is happening here in the island. So you do feel the island a lot emptier than it was, you know, after Hurricane Maria, mainly that it was like when we started to see everything like even more empty, but also a lot of abandonment, you know. And I think that everything has become so expensive, like it's almost like a luxury to live here, you know, like everything is becoming very scary for us, because like we feel that we are basically being obligated to leave the country just because the island is being so like well put it for wealthy people to come and live here. And you know, there's no control, there's no limit, like it's like you feel like the government just want to be on their knees all the time, and they just like want North Americans mostly like just to come here and live here however they want, no matter what it takes. And it's absurd, you know, like it's like we don't want that for our country. Like I know that a lot of people that voted for that party didn't vote for them for that. And I think that we have a very twisted idea of what progress actually is. And like right now we feel like people are associating progress with this situation that is not progress at all. It's displacement. Like we're like being actually like being pushed away from our own country. So for me, like I don't know what the exact solution is, but maybe a good first step would be to have some control over it, because it has been like super out of control. Like not only schools have been closing, like even more schools have been closing and shutting down, but also, you know, schools, buildings that are used as Airbnbs, and there's no limit, you know. It's like it's super weird, and like it's becoming very difficult to live here. And I think that at least, you know, something that could be a good start, it would be that, you know, try to manage the situation, because we feel like no one is managing everything. Like we feel that it's just, you know, I don't know. It's super weird, but definitely, obviously, like keep fighting. But we have, I feel, even though I do expect more people to go out and be, you know, in the streets massively, I feel that because at the same time, the situation has become so delicate, it has been harder for a lot of people to go out and protest, because they are living in a critical situations, you know, especially after Hurricane Fiona. Hospitals are having their crisis as well, and everything is a crisis here. So for me, like it's shocking that you don't see any movement at all for the Puerto Rican people, but you do see everything arranging for the wealthy and the North Americans that come here. So it's, you know, you can feel the lack of interest from the government towards the Puerto Rican people, and it's hurtful.
It is hurtful. I think there's a similar situation happening in Mexico City as well. I don't know if you've read that a lot of North Americans are going down there, Airbnb-ing, working remotely, and the locals are having to leave, basically. So it's a very strange phenomenon that's affecting mainly the poor, right? Across the globe, and it's very unfortunate. I feel your pain and your love towards your country in all of your songs, even if it's not as verbally stated, but you can feel the strength and the force and all the love, you know, in your music, and I really appreciate that. I didn't want to turn this into a sad conversation, but I want our conversation also to have depth and like for people to get to know you as well, you know, not just as a singer, an artist. But por último, just to bring it back to something light and also something personal, I've seen your tattoos. Can you tell me about your favorite one and what's the significance?
I don't know which one is my favorite, but this one is my first one. I was 19. It's a bird. It's from something that I saw about Mafalda, the cartoon, Argentinian cartoon. And it was, I don't know, like it suddenly, it's like from a video, like an animated Mafalda video that I was watching. And she was talking about the birds, and suddenly like this bird, like I connected with it somehow. And also like my sister presented me my Mafalda when I was little, you know, so I known Mafalda when I was a little girl. So it was like almost like a part of me, and just like have her in a way that is not, you know, the cartoon itself, but something related. So yeah, I think it has something like more, you know, it was like my first tattoo, so it's more special because of that.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Ile. Thank you so much for your music. Also, thank you, I didn't mention this, but thank you so much for making space for women in music as well, for paving the way. I think you're amazing.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Gracias.
Por nada. Gracias a ti por estar aquí con nosotros. And we will see you in San Francisco in March.
See you soon.
Gracias.
Chao, gracias.
Chao, Ile. Muchas gracias por todo. Que tengas un bonito día.
Igual tú.
Gracias.
Listening to La Raza Chronicles, Crónicas de la Raza. We're so happy to have on John Santos on our program. John Santos needs no introduction, but for people who don't know his music, they'll discover in just a second. We're going to feature some of his music, but he's a multi-Grammy nominee and incredible instrumentalist, and is known for his knowledge of the music, his improvisation, for his dedication to the craft, and for his work to uplift and share Latin American music, his focus, which is percussion. So John Santos, thank you so much for being here with us. It's truly an honor to have you on the program. It's been a while. You've definitely been on the show before, but it's been a little while and we missed you.
Thank you, Julieta. Always a pleasure to be on KPFA and be in front of KPFA's beautiful audience. I feel at home.
Your career has really been one of just a deep study and sharing these traditions, digging into the Filosofía Caribeña, which is actually the name of your latest release. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this release and your journey?
Okay. In a nutshell, you know, this is Filosofía Caribeña Volume 3. The last Filosofía Caribeña Volume 2, it came out in 2012. So it's been 10 years, you know, since the last one. We did record two records in between. We did one in 2014 with the great Ernesto Oviedo, may he rest in peace, the great elder cantante from Havana. And we did one in 2020 for the Smithsonian called Art of the Descarga. But this continues this theme of Filosofía Caribeña. And this particular one has a subtitle of Puerto Rico del Alma. It's dedicated to Puerto Rico, inspired by Puerto Rico. And it's the first time I'm doing an entire project of Puerto Rican bass themes and music. Mostly it's bombas en plenas. There's a little bit of rumba and conga de comparsa, so some Cuban element, but it's still with Puerto Rican themes in the texts. There's six pieces there that have never been released before that we finished up during the pandemic and up until recently. And there's three pieces that I had released previously on some of my Quindembo projects, which is a folklore project I've maintained over the past few decades. So nobody's really heard them. They're pretty obscure tunes. So it's going to be, I think, like new material for most people. I'm very excited about it because it's always wonderful for me to be able to document what we're working on, what we're writing, what we're concerned with. And I have to give a shout out first and foremost to my sextet, which is the basis of this CD. That would include Saul Sierra on bass, Marco Diaz on piano and trumpet, John Calloway on flute, Charlie Girk on saxes, and David Flores on drum set. And then, as is a custom with me, we have about 30 musicians on this. So even though it's a sextet, I've recorded many records with the sextet and with quintet, but there's never five or six musicians. It's always more like 30 musicians because we bring a lot of guests, in this case, from Puerto Rico, from New York. For the concert on Friday, we have a concert at the Freight, as you know, and we're going to have the sextet and four special guests who all appear on the new album. And that would be Cristel Durandi, the great singer, Jose Roberto Hernandez, another great vocalist, Pedro Pastrana, a great young cuatrista from Puerto Rico, and Shefali Shah, who will be singing a piece that she wrote for the new record.
John Santos, it's so exciting to get a chance to be a part of this incredible album by being able to attend on Friday. So people can purchase your album, but you've given a little insight into some of the other amazing special guests and all the folks that will be joining. For people who maybe aren't familiar with Freight and Salvage or maybe your Puerto Rican music, can you give them a little bit more insight into what they shouldn't miss on Friday?
Well, we're going to play two sets. The first set will be just the sextet playing mainly instrumental music and a little more of our jazz direction with original music. The second set will bring in all of our guests and we'll do music from the new CD. You know, I mean, it's basically dance music, but it's not really salsa. It's bomba en plena mainly and some rumba. So those are all dance forms, but, you know, it's a little bit different than I think what most people are seeing most of the time. For the Puerto Rican community, of course, they know what those things are. We hope to be able to do justice to the material because a lot of it we've never played before live. You know, we prepared it for the studio, you know, recorded the tunes, and I'm very happy with how it came out in the studio. But now we have the challenge of performing it live, and we're getting ready for that. And it's going to be very exciting. It's going to be quite a challenge, and we're really looking forward to it. I think people will enjoy it. You know, we were on the fence about it, you know, because it's a concert / dance event. But because they can't have concert seating and then change it to the dance floor, I think they're going to have a dance floor open the whole time so people can come up close or dance or however they like. And we're looking forward to connecting with the community. I hope that people will come out. I know these are strange times in so many ways and economically, but I hope that people will come out to support this totally homegrown, local, musician-based project.
And something that I love so much about that opportunity is not only will people be able to see you all play, but they'll also get to be in community and they'll get to be in a space with really incredible sound. And as a radio person, sound is very, very important. And the Freight and Salvage is truly built for awesome sounds. So it's not to be missed. Can you remind folks what time, the date of the show, and how they can purchase tickets?
Sure. Yeah, we love the Freight. You know, the Freight has just really opened up their doors to to the extended community. They've been around for like 60 years, something. I mean, really amazing legacy. We love it. And I would have to agree with you that the sound in there is amazing. The show is this Friday, December the 2nd at 8:00. So we do two sets, as I mentioned, one instrumental, one with our special guests, with the vocalists. And that's it. Yeah. The Frate is located at 2020 Addison Street in Berkeley, close to one block, not even a block, half a block from the BART station at Addison and Shattuck, right there in downtown Berkeley.
John Santos, we are so excited to feature fresh off the press. Really, this is probably a world premiere. We're so excited and honored to be able to feature your latest album. So why don't you talk to us about this track that we're going to feature now?
This piece is an original composition. I wrote the lyrics and the music is done by Saul Sierra, our bassist. It's called Plenamente, and it's a plena. It's a plena that features the voice of Cristel Durandi, who's going to be singing this song with us on Friday at the Frate. I'm really happy to say that this features the giant, the young generation giant of the Puerto Rican Cuatro, Mr. Cristian Nieves. He's like just the young lion in Puerto Rico right now. And he did us the great honor of playing on this piece, and he did an amazing job. It also features a wonderful baritone sax solo by Charlie Girk, and Cristel did a great job with the lyrics. And it's a plena that just talks about, you know, what the plena means to us.
John Santos, we appreciate you, and we are so excited to be able to honor and celebrate the release of this latest album, Filosofía Caribeña, Volume 3. And you can see John Santos Sextet live this Friday, December 2nd at 8 p.m. Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you, Julieta. Tito Matos, mi hermano, tu legado es profundo. Mi gratitud eterna.
La plena habla bonita. y los que vienen, siempre abraza nuestra plena con ternura. Nuestra bandera y escudo, a los incensos desnudo, la justicia demuestra, desde el tiempo la colonia, al movimiento laboral, de cualquier barrio marginal, la plena es nuestra historia, y por eso siempre estará, en el cielo, en la gloria.
Exciting opportunity for our listeners to participate in some live music. So we are going to feature the music of La Misa Negra. We have three pairs of tickets to give away, and we're going to give away the tickets for the three people who email us first at larazachronicles@kpfa.org. And we're going to play this a song by La Misa Negra featuring Shay Fiol and Mireya Ramos called Pistola. La Misa Negra plus El Dusty plays this Saturday, December 3rd at 9 p.m. at the New Parish, which is at 1743 San Pablo Avenue at 18th Street in Oakland, California. You can find out more at thenewparish.com. Please email. We're going to take the first three responses. Please include the subject ticket giveaway in the subject. Okay, this is our song. We're going to listen to La Misa Negra now, and don't miss a show this Saturday.
Thank you.
matar.
Listening to La Raza Chronicles, Crónicas de la Raza. If you'd like to stay up on our news, like us on Facebook at La Raza Chronicles on Facebook. If you want to hear this program or share it with a friend, you can go to soundcloud.com/La Raza Chronicles and share it. If you have any ideas for interviews we should be doing or would like to get involved with our collective, you can email us at larazachronicles@kpfa.org. Muchísimas gracias y buenas noches.